From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, a Milwaukee professor studies autism, especially as it impacts children in urban schools.
Later, how two environmental educators are working with classroom teachers to bring learning outdoors.
It's interesting because some teachers do, you know, use the outdoor spaces really frequently and they're really comfortable with it. And some teachers have a lot of reasons that they don't. So kind of what I'm doing is exploring what some of those barriers are.
Plus, a conversation with a mother and daughter, artist and poet, about a recent collection of poems.
And on a recent visit to the Milwaukee Collects exhibition at the Milwaukee Art Museum, curator Margaret Andera explains the key to buying art.
The art of becoming a really good collector is to look and then look some more, and then after you're done looking, keep looking.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark announced yesterday that he is leaving office to join the Trump administration as an assistant secretary in the Department of Homeland Security.
For a reaction to the news, WUWM's Marge Pitroff reached Milwaukee County Supervisor Peggy West, who says she shook her head when she heard the news about a public figure most would describe as outspoken or divisive.
I was obviously disappointed that the federal government would be interested in employing someone like Sheriff David Clark. I'm sure that there are better candidates for that position.
What do you think Sheriff Clark has meant for Milwaukee County?
Well, I know that he's meant dollars in court cases for us. He's cost us money in regards to ICE detainers. His, you know, insistence that we're going to hold people for immigration and naturalization services, although the books prove that they're not paying us, you know, the money that it costs even to hold these individuals. The fact that he has an ethics report that shows that he made $250,000 traveling all around the United States when he's got people dying in his jail. That's a hard thing, I think, for the federal government to overlook. I'm not entirely sure why they feel like he's a good candidate, other than, you know, him sharing their views on undocumented individuals in our country.
After the sheriff submits his letter of resignation, the governor can appoint someone to serve on an interim basis until Milwaukee County holds an election for a new sheriff next year. What would you like to see in the person the governor would appoint to serve Milwaukee in that capacity?
I would love to see someone who embraces a model of community policing. I would love to see someone who embraces working together and interagency cooperation. I would love to see someone who has a corrections background, someone who believes in rehabilitation for our inmates. Jail is supposed to be punitive, but I think also it should be rehabilitative. I would like to see someone who just has some compassion for his fellow man. Someone who, when he finds out that, you know, an inmate is alleging that her child was stillborn because of some type of error within the county jail, would at least say, you know, I'm very sorry for her loss. However, this, and that, instead of having his public statement be that she's a liar. I think this speaks to the Trump administration's willingness to promote people who have been good soldiers versus the people who are actually qualified to do the positions and who also doesn't have such questionable things going on in their current position.
That's Milwaukee County Supervisor Peggy West speaking with WUWM's Marge Pitroff.
Earlier this year, WUWM highlighted racial disparities in our Project Milwaukee series, Segregation Matters. The series looked at the history of segregation in the city and how it impacts things like housing, healthcare, and education.
Those last two issues are at the heart of Elizabeth Drame's work. Drame is the chair of the Exceptional Education Department at UWM. She prepares special education teachers for work, coordinates the Autism Spectrum Disorder Certificate Program at the School of Education, and plans the annual Urban Autism Summit.
Her work has brought her to Senegal, Ghana, and Kenya, where she helps schools develop inclusive education models for the special needs students.
Much of her work focuses on the unique challenges that face special needs students of color. Drame spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about some of the problems African-American communities deal with in diagnosing and helping children with special needs.
I think Black communities in the United States are really faced by systemic disparities that I think are grounded in institutional racism. And so those disparities, I think, compound to the point where we have a disparity in the diagnosis and the overrepresentation of Black people in special education. So kids who are looked at as being problematic and troubling, being identified as having, for example, a behavior disorder, or being viewed to not be speaking correctly, so they're viewed to be having a language disorder or something like that. They end up getting over-identified when they really don't necessarily have a disability. And again, that system of separation and segregation happens through the special education process oftentimes. So there's systematic, I think, disparities in healthcare, in housing, in access to healthy foods, in jobs that provide a living wage for families so that they can access the same resources to supplement education throughout. All of that compounds, and we see that play out in schools as well, too, because Black families and Black students oftentimes, due to systemic problems with adequate housing and all of that, have access to schools that necessarily don't have great outcomes as well. And so you see kind of this layering of challenges, okay? And then when you look at the representation of African-American children in special education, that, I think, reflects a lot of different historical inequities and disparities.
One of the things that you mentioned is the lack of diagnosis, mm-hmm. that often children of color aren't diagnosed the same way that their white peers might be. Has there been some research into why that is?
There is research to support this. So if you look at the data, you'll see that for disabilities that are kind of obvious, right, like deafness, blindness, physical impairment, those kinds of disabilities, you pretty much see what you would expect in terms of percentage of different types of populations being diagnosed with those disabilities. But when you look at the more subjectively or diagnosed disabilities, and what I mean by that is disabilities that occur more frequently and that are reliant on clinical judgment. There's no like blood test, there's no vision test or whatever, there's no genetic test to be able to say you have a learning disability or you have a behavioral disability. There are various different scales, interviews that you do with parents, different diagnostic assessments that you do with kids, which also have historic biases in them as well. Then it's up to kind of looking at the data as a whole and the diagnostician, clinician, psychologist, whoever's doing the assessment, the evaluation, to come to a determination. And oftentimes, educational diagnoses comes through the school setting as a result of a teacher referral. The kids who get diagnosed, you have to initiate a teacher referral if you're doing it through the educational system and not outside through a medical diagnosis. But the teacher's decisions are typically supported. Like their perception of a child as having a disability is typically supported within the diagnostic process. There's a lot of subjectivity embedded within that entire process. And then a lot of times families really will believe what the professionals are telling them, whether or not they feel like there's a different thing, there's something else going on. So there's I think, a lot going on that impacts the representation. Like, for example, if you look at behavior, there isn't a statistically different rate of Black children who fight more versus white children, for example. But if you look at ratings, and this is the discipline disparities data that you can look at, but if you look at disparities around the subjective behaviors like swearing, threatening behavior, violent behavior, disrespectful behavior, behaviors that really depend on the adult's interpretation of that child's behavior, that's where you see huge disparities. You know, you see Black kids who are seen as being more disrespectful or more violent or more disruptive. Well, those are defined by the perceiver, whereas a fight is a fight is a fight. A weapon is a weapon is a weapon. That's very clear. Drugs are drugs are drugs, right? And so when you look at those kinds of offenses, you don't see the kinds of disparities, but you do see disparities where it's based on subjective perceptions.
So switching gears a little bit, I know part of your work has been in several African countries, Senegal, I believe, Kenya, Ghana. Mm-hmm. How does your work there compare with what you do here in Milwaukee?
Well, it's actually very similar, frankly. So the work that I did in Senegal, back in 2011-12, it was funded by a Fulbright Research Fellowship. And I worked with a segregated private school for children with developmental disabilities and then a public school for children with physical disabilities. And basically, I did a participatory kind of evaluation project to do a needs assessment with those centers to find out what their needs were and also to better understand why those children were in those separate settings and why they weren't being educated in general schools. And one of the things that emerged was several of the kids at the private center for developmental disabilities, they had Down syndrome, different kinds of more obvious or known disabilities. And then they also had a group of kids with autism. And so I worked more closely with those teachers of children with autism because they really needed more support in understanding how to work with them, understanding why they were doing certain things. Why did they only eat things that were red and not anything else, not any different colors? Why did they eat it in a corner? And as I worked with them, I started to understand that the families of these children were really struggling to understand their child and what they needed. And because on the surface, they look very, quote unquote, normal. But then why are they screaming? Or why are they hitting? Or why are they biting? Or why are they not eating with the family? Which Senegal is a very collective communal society. You know, family is the nexus of everything, really. And if you have a child that's sitting in a corner taking their food and sitting in a corner, there's something really wrong with that child in the parent's mind. And so what I had to do was one of the things that we did with the teachers, as it was kind of like a train the trainer type approach where I would train the teachers, they would implement the interventions or strategies, and then we would kind of do debriefing. And so one of the things we did was we invited parents to watch these sessions. And then we had a discussion with parents and come to find out with this one particular child that the dad was spanking the child because he was viewing him to be very disrespectful based on his behavior. But then through the observation of the interactions and the intervention session, they understood that where the behavior came from, that the behavior was a result of specific triggering factors and not because the boy was trying to be rude or disrespectful to his father. And so that ended up changing some of the dynamics within the home. And so I think those kinds of things, I think every family struggles with, no matter what cultural context you're in. If you don't really understand the nature of the disability and you don't have the strategies as a family and you're not equipped, or even as a teacher and you're not equipped, it's very easy to take some of the behaviors personally and take it as defiance and opposition and really not be able to work with or work through some of the behaviors.
One of the terms that came up when I was reading the UWM article about your work is many of the families seem to believe their children were bewitched in some in some way. And I think when we hear that, we go to like, oh, they believe in witchcraft and like magic and all these things. But how does that perception of children being bewitched, how does that compare to families in the United States, in Milwaukee or New Orleans, where you've also worked?
Right. I think there's more understanding in different communities here about what underlies, what are potential causes of autism. But I do think there's still a lot of people who don't necessarily understand because, frankly, the field isn't really clear about what causes autism. We know that there's some genetic factors. We know it's a neurodevelopmental disorder. But there's a lot of ideas of, you know, maybe it's food or maybe it's vaccines or maybe it's, you know, environmental toxins or something. And but we're not really sure. And so it's very, I think it's a, you go to what you know and what you believe to be able to try to explain and understand what's happening. Because it is a process of acceptance when a child is, you know, has a condition like autism, for example. It's a process of acceptance and developing understanding and being able to understand that if that child is not using the bathroom and they're 12 years old and they're not independently using the bathroom, they have to be told that it's not something that's willful or that it's, you know, something that they're doing on purpose, so to speak. So when in communities like in some communities in Senegal or even Ghana or wherever, or even Kenya, there's an effort to try to understand. If you don't have the information about this particular disorder in the first place, then you're going to go to what you know. So you're going to try to pray it away. You're going to try to give herb, you know, traditional medicines to help treat it. You're trying to do the best you can as a family. And I think what we need to do is equip families with information so that they can learn to accept their child as they are and to learn to believe that the child actually does have a wonderful future but will need really specific intensive supports in their schools, in their families. And then we need to wrap those supports around them. And in communities like in you know, Kenya or wherever, those supports are much more scarce. They're scarce even here, all right? It's better, but they're scarce even here because of the level of intensity of intervention that's needed early on to really improve the long-term outcomes.
So what are you working on right now? Where is your research going?
So one thing that I'm working on right now is I'm working with a group of amazing African-American moms of children with autism, and we're working on a book. And one of the things that in my research that I've realized is that when you want to try to understand the unique perspectives of groups such as Black families, there's very little out there to understand their very unique journeys, in particular around navigating autism in their families. And so I've worked with this group of moms over the years on planning with the Urban Autism Summit on a variety of different panels and things, and talked to them and said, you know, I really think your voices need to be heard. And then we came together and we were like, we develop a friendship and came together and said, how do we do this? How do we get how do we get these stories out here? And how do we help the audience who would hear those stories? For example, the medical professionals, the educators, the law enforcement. How do we help them to better understand what our unique experiences are so that that these professional communities that interface with families can learn and do better? Because they've had some really challenging circumstances throughout the time that they've had a child with autism. And so that's what we're working on. So we will see what happens with that.
I look forward to seeing it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with me, Elizabeth, and thanks for sharing your work.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Elizabeth Drame is the chair of the Exceptional Education Department at UWM, and she spoke with Joy Powers. You can learn more about her work by going to WUWM.com.
A quick break now, and then we'll learn about the work of two environmental educators who are trying to break down barriers and help classroom teachers work outdoors. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.
Continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Spring is in full bloom around Wisconsin for a few days anyway.
The warmer temperatures mean plenty of folks are looking for opportunities to get outside, including teachers in two local school districts who are searching for ways to take their lessons outdoors.
It's something the folks in Cedarburg and West Bend Public Schools have been working on all year with the help of a couple of scientists in residence.
Thanks to funding and support from the River Edge Nature Center, environmental educators Kendra Swanson and Megan Johnson have partnered with these schools to help students and teachers rethink how to incorporate nature into their learning and make outdoor time a vital part of the school day across all subjects.
We're sure they'll be out there today. It is, in fact, National Outdoor Classroom Day. To celebrate, Lake Effect's Rachel Morello took her own field trip to see Kendra, Megan, and their classes in action.
My name is Kendra Swanson. I'm the scientist in residence for the Cedarburg School District.
So what does that mean? What are your duties?
It's a community-funded position as a result of the partnership between River Edge Nature Center and the Cedarburg School District. And basically what I'm doing is I'm helping to understand teachers' needs for using outdoor spaces, helping to provide a support system. It's interesting because some teachers do, you know, use the outdoor spaces really frequently and they're really comfortable with it. And some teachers have a lot of reasons that they don't. So kind of what I'm doing is exploring what some of those barriers are and also thinking about different ways to improve the outdoor spaces or to increase just kind of like, you know, our open-mindedness about the valuable things that come from learning outside. The position is kind of like where community overlaps, schools overlaps the Nature Center.
So do you kind of feel like a teacher? Do you feel like an assistant? Like if a kid had to describe your position to their parent, how do you think they would describe you?
is the person that helped them touch bugs. My background is in non-formal education, so I do really consider myself to be an educator. But also as my role in the schools, I really kind of enjoy the fact that I don't have to like be a classroom teacher. I don't have to maintain like the same kinds of like boundaries and structure as regular teachers do, but I can be, you know, kind of an extra part of like the learning community. And that's kind of how I view myself, as a supporter of teachers and an enthusiastic extra person. My office is in the middle school, 6th through 8th grade. And like, it's just so hard to be that age. And I feel like as many positive extra people that can be around, the more adults we have kind of supporting students and learning, the better it is. And I think the more different kinds of learning that kids are able to see, like maybe they're not a really, really great classroom learner, but that doesn't mean they're a bad student. It doesn't mean they're incapable of learning in other ways. So outdoor education and this kind of education really provides an opportunity to help cater to kids that don't necessarily learn best at desks. Okay, so this game is called Instincts for Survival, okay? And it is the culminating project. You guys have been talking about food chains. You've been talking about food webs. Have you guys used the phrase trophic pyramid at all?
No.
Okay, I'm gonna jump you into that as well. Trophic pyramid is just a different way of—
Hello, my name is Sherry Rowe. I teach 4th grade moves at Parkview Elementary in Cedarburg. Kendra and the 4th grade teachers have worked together. We reached out to Kendra to specifically help us with the plant and animal adaptation units, but really it's turned into something much bigger and better, and getting the kids outside and really appreciating the environment near Parkview and right in our own backyard, the woods that's right there. And so it's really tied into all different subject areas. And the more we work with her, the more we want to do for more units in the future. It is so nice to have someone on staff that has these activities planned. And so she takes care of preparing it all and working a schedule so that she's leading those activities, which really gets us outside even more than what we used to be.
So you're gonna be playing a game in the whole park, and your job is to survive, okay? So what are three things that we need to survive? We're gonna go through them. We need food, water, don't die. Okay, let's do that one more time later. Food,
water, don't die.
Good. Sometimes you go outside just for the sake of being outside, but what we're trying to do is really find where those curricular connections are, so it seems like it fits better in the day and fits better in what they're doing.
Megan Johnson.
And you're a scientist in residence?
Yep, for the West Bend School District. This year we are targeting grades kindergarten and 4th grade, but working with almost all the grade levels and, you know, developing curriculum to get kids outside learning and just getting them to be outside, experiencing what nature has to offer in different settings, whether that's science, language arts, social studies. Today we have 1st graders coming out here.
So tell me about what you're going to do with the 1st graders.
Yeah, so today they're doing a plants unit. So they're going to be doing 4 stations. The teachers will be leading the stations, and they'll rotate on about a half hour and be doing drawing plants, building plants, talking about seeds and how they disperse, and talking about what plants need to survive, and playing a game. So it's a lot of hands-on. They're going to be in the woods the whole time. They'll be applying the knowledge they've already learned in their classroom out here. So this is the unit they're covering right now in school, and they're going to just take that knowledge and directly apply it to the outdoors.
We can figure this out, guys.
A leaf.
That's a flower.
What are you guys building? Can you tell me?
A tomato plant.
Yeah,
a tomato plant.
Did I do good or what?
One more leaf! One more leaf!
When I think about when I was a kid and I used to go outside during school, it was either for recess or it ended up being like recess, because you're not in a classroom, you're not at a desk. It's a freer experience, I guess.
Yeah.
Are there challenges with taking them off site, taking them out of their traditional setting and trying to still do learning when you're out here?
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge, and that's something that I think a lot of teachers bring up is like the behavioral piece of it. And, you know, we're trying to find ways to set that up. And so the first thing to that is that the more they do it and they go outside to learn, the more they are used to it. And so they're just used to that standard. And so getting teachers to really set, you know, we're going outside to learn, we're not going outside for recess, and then holding them to that. But also allowing some of that kind of free form learning, where I think, you know, in a classroom, it's pretty structured. They have their goals. They meet every day. When we're learning outside, you know, today we're learning about plants, but if we see a cool insect or a worm, there's nothing wrong with them picking them up and learning about it as well. And so it takes a little tweaking on the teacher's part to like adjust to that as well. But yeah, that structure of it not being recess, but it's still being, you know, a little free range on the learning. And the kids love it. They get to see things and do things that they've never seen or experienced before. And so it's not recess, but it's still, you know, a little more loose than in the classroom.
You sound like you get pretty excited about it too.
Oh yeah, I love it. I mean, it's great, especially days like today. I mean, I'm standing out here right now, and I'm just like, oh, I can't wait to like get out here, and the kids get excited, and you kind of feed off their energy. They're so excited because it's something new for them. You know, they're having fun. The teachers are having fun, and it's just, it builds your excitement. And when you see them leave and they're like, I don't want to leave, this was so much fun, you know, can we do this every day? It's like, okay, yeah, like this is, you know, it's worthwhile, and it's great to see that happening.
Okay. Got to see some cool plants, right? What one was your favorite one?
The one that was the garlic.
Oh, the garlic mustard? Yeah, because it smelled like garlic.
And the blood.
You're listening to the sounds of an outdoor classroom in the West Bend School District run by scientist in residence Megan Johnson. Megan and her colleague Kendra Swanson spoke with LakeFX Rachel Morello.
We'll learn about psychologist and poet Sarah Rosenblatt's most recent collection of poems when LakeFX continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. As both a psychologist and a poet, Sarah Rosenblatt has a unique advantage in dissecting the psyche of the average person. The family psychologist says she uses her work as a way of connecting with people, creating poems that speak to the curiousness of life and the human condition.
Her third collection of poems was released last fall. The collection is called Where Are We in This Story? And includes line drawings from her mother, Suzanne.
Both Sarah and Suzanne Rosenblatt joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio in November to talk about this most recent book and how her new poems compare to her previously published work.
They're more succinct. They're kind of, in some ways, not as experimental as I used to, but I still think they're good in their own right, despite the fact that I, you know, love experimental poetry. But they are also kind of, I don't know, pretty centered, I think.
They're the results of your experiments.
Yeah, they are experimental in my own way. They're just not like, you know, like a John Ashbery or whatever, and I love his work, but they are me, so they are just what they should be, you know.
So they're a bit more refined.
They're more refined. You've got it.
Maybe you should be a poet.
You got it.
So what connects these poems in the collection?
Well, I tend to write a lot about time passing, about human vulnerability, about just the strangeness of time passing, and, you know, the strangeness of kind of being alive, being human. And that's definitely what interests me in general. I find it very interesting.
Many of your poems really seem to speak to the kind of indifferent forces that often govern our daily lives. Do you think that's accurate?
Definitely. I would say they're existential. I would say they're existential. And it's just sort of like, as one of my clients would say, existential angst. But I still think they're hopeful, even though they're existential. I think they're hopeful because even if we are just put here and there's a lot of indifference of the world around us, there's still a lot of beauty in the world, too. So I think there's a mixture, not just angst.
Now, you mentioned one of your clients might say that. And in your other life, your non-poet life, you're a child and family therapist, which I think is really interesting since so many of the poems seem to focus on this kind of grind of life and almost the banality of entropy, as it were. Do you feel like these two pursuits are at odds or do they feed off of one another?
Well, I don't think they're at odds, because as a therapist, you kind of have to know yourself and know what you're thinking about in your core. And these are kinds of the things that come up when I'm writing. So I think if you understand all the various different feelings and different thoughts and different things people have in their life, both the beauty and the existential angst, then you kind of understand yourself more, and then you can maybe hopefully understand other people too, because they're thinking all those things too. I mean, I don't think it's just me.
Do you draw inspiration in some ways from your clients, from their lives?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't necessarily write about them, my clients individually, although sometimes I may. But I think everyone I know and get to know, and I get to know people all the time, they're all an adventure. And then having known them affects who I am and what I write about and what I think about. So they may be mentioning something in therapy to me, and it might come as something that will come out in the poem.
So many of the poems feel very intimate, in part because they are a reflection of how you view the world in many ways. Suzanne, what do you think when you read your daughter's poetry?
I think she's a natural poet. I knew it from the time she was in ninth grade, I think, and she wrote some poems, and like we are pecking away in the air-conditioned rooms. I mean, it was such a strong image. Here I am. I won't tell you how many years later. And I haven't seen that in a long time. But I thought, wow, she understands kind of the banality of people's lives in a sense. And then there was another one about ducks and people eating at a table and the conversation. Well, she was always very insightful, even as a young person. And it showed that she could really see what society was like and all the things that she deals with now. And she was dealing with words in a very beautiful, deep way. So...
Now, your artwork is actually included...
Yeah, in all three books.
Why did you decide to include so much of your mother's artwork?
Because I just thought it worked really well with the poems. And that's why. Because so you don't get just a poetry book, you get a poetry book and an art book, you know? And I feel like they're kind of whimsical, like, well, the poems can be at times.
Can you describe them a bit?
The art? Well, for me, like this picture here, the crosshairs in our noses are cross-cut with darkness. I just love this because it's almost like the drawings of the people's heads and their bodies are all, they look like they're all hairs. And I love that title of the chapter, The Crosshairs in Our Noses Are Cross-Cut by Darkness. I don't know why. There was something very body-like.
And none of the drawings were done with a particular poem in mind. As Sarah Wendt goes through all my drawings before the book is published and picks out the ones that she feels relate to her poems. And she has a wide selection.
This one, Nested at Last, that's my niece.
Oh.
And we have, I don't know if these are my boys here or the cousins,
your
my
niece and
nephew.
Yeah.
And my son is in a lot of these.
Yeah.
A lot of the drawings.
Yeah.
But I just think my mom's loose drawings work really beautifully with the poems. And I happen to love the cover here. I don't know. I just thought it's a great cover. I was so happy with it when I got it in the mail about a week ago.
So in a perfect world, what do you hope people take away from your book? How do you hope they receive it?
Well, I just think it's about kind of like the joy of coming across something that like maybe hits them on a deeper level where they can go, oh, yeah, I felt that way, you know? Just the very transitory joy of connecting with something. That they feel like, oh yeah, I felt that way at times. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. That kind of thing.
Sarah Rosenblatt is a Milwaukee-based poet and family psychologist. Her latest collection, Where Are We in This Story, features drawings from her mother, Suzanne Rosenblatt. Both Sarah and Suzanne will read from their writing Sunday at Woodland Pattern Book Center in a public event honoring the memory of father and husband Adolph Rosenblatt, who was also an artist and a professor of art at UWM. He passed away in February. There's more information at WUWM.com.
A major exhibition of works loaned by Milwaukee collectors is on display for a few more days at the Milwaukee Art Museum. We'll revisit our visit when Lake Effect continues on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Normally, the temporary exhibition housed in the College Trevor wing of the Milwaukee Art Museum showcases artworks from well beyond Milwaukee's borders. We've seen furniture from early 19th century Vienna, films from 1930s Germany, and impressionist paintings from mid to late 19th century France.
But since March, the space has been home to a cornucopia of art that normally lives right here in town. Milwaukee Collects was a collaboration between several Milwaukee Art Museum curators and nearly 50 collectors. The range of work spans centuries and media.
Two of the Milwaukee collectors agreed to be interviewed along with the curators who worked with them in front of the pieces they loaned for the exhibition. Sandy Robinson and curator Margaret Andera and Eckhart Grohman and curator Tanya Paul met with Bonnie North at the museum, and Tanya Paul described to her what it was like to put the show together.
It was actually a lot of fun, I have to say. I think Margaret would agree. I think we have a really great team, and it was really great to sort of have these. We set aside a war room, basically, and we like spread everything out on the table, and we're like, okay, these are the things we're really interested in. We kind of really started honing in on stuff. We had a big board up on the wall of pictures that people had agreed to lend, and it was a fun process of kind of honing in on who we were really interested in talking to, what pieces were really amazing that we wanted to make sure we secured for the show, and just sort of that whole process was just, it was really fun and collaborative.
What I really found interesting about it was that there was this immediate sense of feedback. So when you're working by yourself, you'll have an idea of like, I wonder if we should have a gallery that's dedicated to just text in art, which ended up being a gallery that we titled Word is Image. And normally I would, you know, sit with that idea, and until I actually sat down with somebody, it wouldn't come up, but you could just say it around the model, and immediately everybody said, yes, let's do that. So the collaborative process definitely has its advantages.
Back up even a little more, how did you identify the pieces that you wanted and the collectors who had them?
I think that all of us have a certain sense of, as they say, where the bodies are buried, but like who the good collectors in the community are, who has really great things, and then of those collections, you know, what are the really sort of pieces that get you really excited. And I think Margaret has had this experience as well. As we went through the process, I actually ended up meeting new collectors that I didn't know before, because as I was talking to people, they said, oh, you know, you should really talk too. And then they connected me with their friends.
Some collectors we didn't realize had been collecting for as long or had different types of work. Like I thought one particular collector collected a very specific type of contemporary art, and then all of a sudden there were other things. And so it was really rewarding in that respect as well.
Okay, collectors, I'm going to bring you in on this now. So when the idea of this show came up, were you excited? Is this something you wanted to participate in, or did you have to be convinced?
Be honest now.
Be honest.
Well, I was a little hesitant because I ordinarily don't think of myself as a collector. I've just learned to embrace that title to myself. But when Margaret approached me, she said, can I come over and take a look at some of your things? I said, certainly, I'd love to have you come over and take a look. So she identified a piece, and I was just very honored to have it be a part of this collection and a part of this show.
Had you met any of the other collectors before? Did you know of everybody who's part of the show?
Not everybody, but I know most of the people because I am a trustee. So I have been in some of the homes, and I've been in some of the homes, and yes, I knew some of the people.
Okay.
Yes.
And sir, for you?
Well, I thought the idea was very good, especially when you have a new director.
who wants to be, have contact with the community. And the collectors are the ones that really also support the museum. The idea to connect the collectors and the community with the museum, especially after the new opening and the renovations, I thought was a terrific idea. So I was happy to participate.
Well, let's go to, because we're focusing on two different parts, and so this is going to be the European,
yeah,
is that right?
That's right.
Collection, and then also contemporary art.
Absolutely.
Okay, so mm-hmm. Do we want to start with Tanya, with you? With
yeah,
you,
we're actually
right in
right
it.
Here.
Right there. So you'll have to describe the painting for me, please, and who did it, and then we'll get into some details.
The name is The Golden Wedding Dance. And the scene plays in a village near Frankfurt, Willingshausen, which was a colony of painters that liked to go there, similar to Barbizon, south of Paris. This painting was done by Ludwig Knaus, a very capable and popular painter of the 19th century. It was painted in 1859. And when Goupil, which was a major art dealer in those days, saw the picture almost completed, he talked Ludwig Knaus into finishing it for the Salon to show it 1859 in Paris, where it got several prizes, got a lot of attention. The picture was in form of lithographs widely published. The original was, after the show in Paris, shown once more in Vienna in 1862 in Cologne, then disappeared. Nobody knew where it was. One thought it was probably destroyed in the war, possibly sold to America, but it was not known. In all the books about Ludwig Knaus, it was pictured black and white. Those days it didn't have any color photography. And then all of a sudden, it came on the market. I bought it because I liked the scene. I went to school close to that village. So I bought it not knowing that this is considered one of the major genre paintings of the 19th century.
And so Tanya, talk a little bit from an art history and curatorial standpoint, what makes this painting so special? Well, first of all, I'm standing here looking at it and I'm loving the light.
Yeah.
I'm loving the way the light picks up the figure, certain figures dancing, and the way the shadows work. And it feels bucolic.
Yes, absolutely. So the scene is this wonderful country wedding with this elderly couple sort of dancing and all of their fellow village, inhabitants around. And Knaus is really wonderful for all of the sort of incidental detail that he includes in his paintings. The children are particularly wonderful. The dogs are actually worth seeking out if you come see the picture.
But there's more than one.
Yes, yep. There are. But the thing that it's wonderful that you notice the light, because that's the thing that I think really makes this painting so special. Because he was working on the painting or thinking about the painting in Willingshausen, and then he's painting this actually in Paris. This moment when he is kind of combining what he has learned in Germany with what he's seeing around him in Paris. So the painting becomes this sort of unique hybrid in a really wonderful way. So he's thinking and looking at all these other plein air painters, and he's inspired by the way that they are working to capture light and a sense of immediacy and a sense of a sort of that fleeting moment being captured.
Let us move to something completely different. Okay. We're heading into the Contemporary Gallery, is that correct? That's the one. I love that. I love that piece. I like that. There's so many pieces in here that I like. I know. Okay, so Margaret, if you would please describe where we are in the exhibition.
So we're into the contemporary section, and we're in a small gallery that is dedicated to works that deal with identity and self-presentation. So how artists present their own identities. It's not always through portraits of themselves or images of themselves. It can often be of other people who kind of, they take on a persona, artists take on a persona like Cindy Sherman or Adolf Wolfley. But the work we're going to talk about is in Sandy's collection by an artist named Tiana Bowie, who we could say was a local artist. She was a Milwaukee artist, but she no longer lives here. Her art career has blossomed, and she's moved to Detroit. But the thing I love about this work is it's in this gallery, and you look around, and it's the only image that doesn't show a human figure, but it's still about identity.
So tell me how you first of all learned about the artist and then about this particular painting and how you came to acquire it.
Well, I learned about the artist from the Haverty Museum. They used to have a show called Current Tendencies, and they would feature up and coming artists, and Tiana Bowie was one of the artists, and at that time she was an instructor at MIAD. So as soon as I saw her work at the Haggerty at that Current Tendency show, I made it my business to get down to MIAD and introduce myself to her. And I've been following her work ever since then. And I have one other piece by her. But then when I saw this at the Dean Jensen Gallery, I knew that I had to have this one because actually this is a portrait of me. It's almost like a portrait of every African-American woman because this is an experience that every African-American woman has had and is still going on today because we have a very complicated relationship with hair. So although this is a minimalist image, kind of large, it's the largest one in my collection, and there's only one thing on it. It's an image of a hot comb, also called a pressing comb or a straightening comb. And actually, a hot comb is only about the size of a knife. But it has metal teeth. But this, she's rendered it really, really large because it plays such a significant role in the life of an African-American woman. So what you do with that hot comb, this is what my mother used to do with me. She'd bring me into the kitchen, sit me by the stove, and you'd put that hot comb, which has metal teeth and a wooden handle, you'd put that hot comb on the stove. And then when it was really hot, they'd put some oil on your hair, take that hot comb and straighten out your hair. Because, you know, our hair was coarse and kinky, and the ideal was to have it straight and silky. So you tried to get your hair straight and silky. So they sizzled out your hair until it got straight. And then, you know, sometimes a comb would slip, so you get little burn marks on your ear and around your neck,
or your neck
or your forehead or that kind of thing. So this was a ritual almost every couple of weeks because when your hair got wet, it would course back up again. You had to straighten it out again. So Easter, Mother's Day, Christmas, Thanksgiving, every couple of weeks, you would get your hair straightened. And, you know, Tiana has a big shock of hair, big, thick, coarse hair. So she is someone who definitely, when she was a child, would have had her hair straightened. And so when I saw this, I thought, ah, this was my life when I was a child. All it shows is just the comb, the muted background. You need say no more. I mean, every African-American woman walks in here, maybe not only African-American women, but when every African-American woman walks in here, ah, it's immediate identification of, you know, part of our culture and part of our growing up experience.
Collectors, they have this relationship with art that curators can sort of lose sight of sometimes because we're in the museum world and we are thinking about art in somewhat different ways. But to hear Sandy talk about that moment when she walked into Dean Jensen Gallery, looked at this work and said, that's me. I mean, that's really how art inspires people. I would also say that the two collectors you're talking to today are poster children. When people say, how do I become a good collector? ask them both. They go and they look. And Sandy first saw Tiana's work at the Hagerty Museum, and then she saw it at Dean Jensen. And so she's always, everywhere she goes, she travels to Cleveland, she'll go to museums and galleries there. The art of becoming a really good collector is to look and then look some more, and then after you're done looking, keep looking.
So do you have room for more art? Both of you? Is there always room for more art?
There is always room for more art. There is always room for more art. In fact, I bought a piece a couple of weeks ago. And I said, where am I going to put it? But it doesn't matter. There's always room for more art. The other thing, too, I buy catalogs. And if there are a lot of artists that I can't afford. I like buying contemporary art because I like to eyeball the artist. So I always have a conversation. I try to track them down whenever I can. But a lot of them are out of my price range, so I will get the catalog and, you know, enjoy looking at the images in the catalog and reading the text and that kind of thing. But I do still buy art.
Yes. And you?
Well, I do. What happens to collectors that actually outgrow than what they started and ever hoped to be for? You run out of all space, especially with paintings. Mm-hmm. And that happens to many.
Yes.
And then you want to have a home where the collection can be housed beyond your lifespan.
It has been interesting working on this show, though, because you go through with each individual collector and you see, you know, we've brought in sometimes multiple works from one collector, and the personality of the collector is very much reflected in their collection. I mean, Sandy talks so personally about the work that she collected. Eckhart talked about growing up in the village that's in, you know, nearby the painting that he collected. But throughout all of these collectors that are represented in this exhibition, there are, you know, some collectors you can tell have a more whimsical sense of humor about what the works they collect. The design people have much more of kind of this eye, the way they look at the world. And photography people, you know, some of the photos in here are very much about kind of reducing things you see in your everyday life down to these broad shapes. So it's just so interesting to see how the personalities of each collector are reflected in the works that they choose to purchase.
Would you two participate in something like this again?
Sure.
Yeah?
Right now I have several Spitzbergs in Vienna, where there's a big show first about Spitzberg in Austria. And then we have the Ludwig Knaus coming up in Wiesbaden, in Germany. So yes, I have loaned pictures out, and I think why not share it with the public?
And yes, I definitely would. I gave a piece from my collection to the Museum of the Wormir Bearden print that I think back in the 80s or something, I gave that to the museum, so it's part of the museum's permanent collection. So I love collecting art and sharing it, and I would definitely love to participate in a show like this again.
Well, I want to thank all of you for taking time to talk a little bit about your passion and seeing the work with new eyes in both cases, but thank you all so much.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Collector Sandy Robinson and Eckhart Grohman loaned works to the Milwaukee Art Museum for its Milwaukee Collects exhibition, which runs through May 21st. Margaret Andera and Tanya Paul are two of the curators involved in putting the show together. There are photos of the two works they described at WUWM.com. And that's all for the Thursday edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and please be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.